I'm often talking about the simple act of choosing learning over knowing. And that is to say, that is to recognize that our spontaneous, again, our spontaneous reaction is of knowing. We think we're right. Like we've sized up the situation, we've got the causal map, and we're right. We rarely spontaneously, although I think we can get better at it, think, I wonder what I'm missing. Like, I wonder where I'm not right here. Where is my first glance assessment of what's going on wrong? To me, that is an act of choosing learning, right? And learning's uncomfortable, even though it's fun. It's uncomfortable because it's sort of saying, I have to deliberately, explicitly let go of what I believe to be true and instead say, what am I missing?
There is a deep conversation that can awaken our potential and stir our soul. A conversation that explores the possibility of living and loving as fully as we can. A possibility that begins with the practice of opening to life as we move through fear and make the conscious choice to pursue what matters most from a place of courage, wisdom, and love. I'm Joshua Steinfeld, and this is the Courageous Life Podcast. Failure is a concept and an experience that is deeply embedded into our lives. As we learn to walk, we fall. As we learn to ride a bike, we usually fall again. Today's guest, Dr. Amy Edmondson, even writes in her new book, Right Kind of Wrong, to err is human. It's actually the title of one of the chapters. And yet, even though it's so familiar, so intertwined with our journey through life, not all failure is created equal. How do we fail well? What are the crucial distinctions that might help us separate good failure from bad? And how do we learn to identify when failure is our friend and to prevent most of it when it's not? These bigger questions about failing wisely, failing intelligently, are at the core of our conversation today. Dr. Amy Edmondson is back on the show again, and together we'll explore how we can stay open to learning from failure at the individual and the team level, how leaders can create the conditions for learning in the face of failures, including an inspiring story that Amy will share of one of the world's leading CEOs and how they created psychological safety in the midst of a crisis, the importance of curiosity before blame, including a simple practice of asking, what happened? Amy will offer insight into the reasons why most failures are not blame-worthy. And yet, that's often the knee-jerk reaction in organizations and in many different parts of life. Amy will also unpack the three types of failure and how diagnosing which type is occurring can lead to learning from and preventing further failure. We'll also get into a conversation about the painful emotions that can arise in the face of failure and the importance of compassion and giving ourselves and others permission to be human. We'll also discuss how embracing uncertainty and vulnerability can support failing wisely. And Amy will share some reflections about why failure is not an equal opportunity proposition and her vision for a world where everyone has equal license to fail. And we'll close out the conversation with a few reflections on the importance of play, having fun, experimenting, taking some risks, trying new things, and why practicing in low-stakes situations has tremendous upside when it comes to getting better at failing. Amy once again offers a ton of insight and practical takeaways in this conversation. And I would encourage you to listen in a way that's beneficial for your own learning. Maybe capturing notes of things you want to remember, or even pausing at points to take something in. If you want to dive deeper into Amy's work around failure, I would highly recommend picking up a copy of her new book, Right Kind of Wrong, The Science of Failing Well, which you can find wherever books are sold. And for most of you, I doubt much of an introduction to Amy is needed, but in case you're not familiar, here are a few highlights from her incredible career. Ranked number one on the latest Thinkers 50 ranking of the world's most influential management thinkers, Amy C. Edmondson is the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at the Harvard Business School, a chair which was established to support the study of human interactions that lead to the creation of successful enterprises that contribute to the betterment of society. Amy's the author of 7 books and over 60 scholarly papers. She's a sought-after keynote speaker with a worldwide following. For more, visit amycedmondson.com. All right, I think that's about enough of an intro from me. Without any further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Amy Edmondson. All right. Well, Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I remember as we were talking about before jumping on recording, very fondly sitting down for a conversation at the business school at Harvard pre-pandemic, which seems like a world away in many ways. But thank you for your generosity. It was an amazing conversation then, and I'm very excited for today. Really looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So during our initial conversation, since this is the courageous life, I always start by asking whether there was some sort of adversity or challenge that you may have faced anywhere in your career. And you generously shared during that conversation the challenge that you outlined at the beginning of Right Kind of Wrong, your new book. So I'm curious, since we're talking about failure today, and it's your second time on the show, if there's any other challenge or time that you failed that you'd be willing to share, talk a little bit about as a way in, maybe not only what the failure was, but maybe what you learned from it or how you grew from it or how it influenced your career, something like that.
So many little ones or, you know, failures that seemed painful at the time, but really don't sound important enough, I think, you know, like not making a team in high school or something. And you know, Josh, what's hard about this is that it's kind of a version of the humble brag. Mm-hmm. A couple of failures are coming to mind that were quite painful at the time, or, you know, seemed to be not career ending, but career limiting and requiring pivots. And then they worked out so beautifully, right? So, you know, I feel sheepish about it.
Sure.
But I don't know if you want me to just take a stab at that or not.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, happy you named it. Something that I'll just share before you jump into the story is something I feel that might be important in retrospect when it comes to failure. At the time, and maybe you have some thoughts about this as well, at the time of a failure, it can feel particularly painful, and it is because it's our experience. And then looking back for you to say with a different perspective, oh, I've either healed from that or I've grown from that, or in retrospect, it's whatever, it's led me to some sort of new insight or something along, or I'm stronger because of it. I think there's a power in that, you know, things can heal with time, or the strength that comes from time. I mean, is this something that you see when you speak to people about failure?
Yes, absolutely. And I certainly have many stories in the book, Right Kind of Wrong, that fall into that category. Mostly for other people, because it's not a book about me, even if it opens with that story that sure. I shared with you. But the particular challenge I'm thinking of is that in the two stories that came to mind, the silver lining was both quick and, I mean, not super quick, but almost too easy, right? So here, I'll give you one and see what you
Please.
Think.
Please, yeah.
Right, so I was a very early assistant professor, and I had a a paper accepted at a conference that I would argue is a, there's big conferences where everybody's competing to get into them. And then there are little sort of specialty conferences that are for just people interested in a narrow area of research. And this was more of the latter. The paper was accepted in the conference. I think that, again, it's not even a particularly sort of competitive or hot area of research. And so it's a pretty fun and comfortable conference to be at, present the work. And then coming out of the conference, some subset, I don't know what percentage, but probably at least, a quarter or a third of the papers would be accepted for a special issue of a journal, not a top journal, just a kind of medium journal. And because this is the kind of conference where there's not that many people from Harvard Business School, let's say, I had a lot of confidence that my paper would get accepted into the special issue of the journal. And it was not. It was rejected. I mean, I feel bad. There's a little bit of arrogance in thinking it should get accepted, although I thought it was a pretty good paper, at least interesting and good, interesting data and an interesting company. I mean, I was fond of the paper, let's put it that way. But I guess the editors of the journal were not as fond of it as I was. And like all rejections, it's a little bit painful. Mm-hmm. And from a career perspective, it's a setback. And so sitting there with that setback and those, painful emotions, then finally I said to myself, well, what next? What do you do? And in a sense, there's a fork in the road. Well, I suppose there's three options. One is just throw it in the trash, but you don't do that, right? Mm-hmm. And one is you try to make some improvements in it and send it to a lesser journal. Mm-hmm. And the other is you try to make some improvements in it and send it to a better journal, which is quite counterintuitive in my field and I suppose in any aspect of science. If you get rejected from a medium journal, you don't go down, you go down, not up, right? But you probably see this coming. I decided to try to improve it and send it to a better journal because why not? I was an early stage assistant professor and these things matter. So, I did what I could. Now, I got very lucky at that point because the editor at this better journal, I think, saw enough in it, saw the diamond in the rough. It was not a great paper, but saw the opportunity to help me make it a great paper, as did, I guess, some of the reviewers. And so ultimately, of course, you see this coming. It got accepted at that better journal, has been fairly widely cited. It's not my most cited paper, but it's a paper I like very much. And some people really love it. It's kind of unusual. It's qualitative and it gets into some interpersonal dynamics and teams that I think are quite fascinating. So it was a little like mini crucible of disappointment that because I decided to take seriously its weaknesses and decided to be even more ambitious with it, ended quite well.
Thank you for being willing to play. Stepping into the unknown a little bit there and okay, let's jump into it. And, and you might see this coming, but I'm curious as a follow-up, just to drill down a little bit in your own experience, we'll get into kind of the research and more and unpack that in a moment. But for you in that moment when you were rejected or shortly thereafter, what was it that you did? And maybe it was reframing, maybe it was some sort of other strategy, maybe it was something that you said to yourself to keep pushing forward and make it better and then pursue the better, more prestigious journal.
I think reframing is an element of it. I have a knee-jerk, okay, I give up. Right. And maybe other people do too, right? Like setback, failure, I give up, right? I'm not cut out for this field. And that's the instant reaction. And so, the reframing there is, come on, that's overplaying the meaning of this event. So it's reframing followed by recommitting maybe to courage, but also to ambition in a positive way, right? It's sort of saying, you can do this. And if you have any chance of succeeding in this field and as an academic, you've got to do it, right? You've got to do whatever you can to make this good enough to get published. And so sorry. You know, that's what's, mm-hmm. that's what you've put on your plate, Amy. Mm-hmm. You know, you've accepted a job that requires you to do this. So just rise to the challenge and do it.
So I love that. And I think what I'm curious about is that knee-jerk reaction for you. And this may, you know, depend on situation and circumstance and the degree of the failure or the challenge. But how much time might pass between letter of rejection and then knee-jerk response or thought, oh, I'm not going to hack it in this.
That's quick. Or, that's no so time at all. That's instant. Yeah.
And then afterward, the next step where you get into the reframing, is that like take a breath and reframe? Is that like overnight? What does that look like for you?
It's either several hours or overnight. I can't remember exactly on that one. It's not months, right? But it's not minutes.
You know, anytime we're having an important conversation, particularly around a topic like failure, which is so inherent, innate in the human experience. I mean, learn how to walk. What happens? You fall over and then you get up again. You know, failure is just there, I feel like, from the beginning. Right. And so it's this big word and it can have a lot of meanings to different people and we might have different associations with it. A starting point might be just with a definition. What does it mean to fail? What is meant? What do you mean by failure?
You said something very important there, which is it's a big word or it's a little word that covers big territory, way too much territory to be meaningful. So I define failure as an undesired result. Undesired for sure. We'd always prefer success to failure. And result, meaning it's the outcome of something, some effort. So it's not just a random event. You know, if a meteor came in this window just now, that wouldn't be a failure. It would be kind of a wild thing, right? But it has to be, a failure is the result of some action or effort to achieve some outcome and you fail. You don't get what you want. You get this other thing that is undesired. And so that definition, I think it's pretty precise, but it's also hugely encompassing. I mean, that can cover everything from not getting to an important meeting on time and maybe some, you know, bad things happen about that. You know, I burnt the cookies, to an airline crash that takes 78 lives. Right? So it's covering a lot of territory, but it is an undesired result of some effort.
You know what's coming to mind, and we can get into this a little bit about why it's difficult to fail, but as kind of a lead-in, just popping into my head right now, is there's a Center for Compassion. CCARE stands for the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University.
Huh.
And so they study compassion, and there's an 8-week training program that they've developed, and it's an evidence-based program for the secular training of compassion. And I've gone through this program and teach compassion classes and this type of thing. And there's all these different skills you learn in the process. But compassion is a loving response to suffering. And what's interesting about suffering is that one of the ways to think about it, and there can be different definitions for suffering, but is I want something to be different than it is. And this existing on a huge continuum.
That's
right?
True. Like, tiny. Yeah.
Yeah. From like a little, you know, from a kid who walks into the ice cream store and goes, right. I wanted vanilla, but they only have chocolate. And it's like, you know, or whatever. I'm diagnosed with a terminal condition and I want that to be different than it is. Right. So it's interesting that you're talking about this undesired result.
So it's the
when
same.
When it comes to failure, it's very similar.
So failure involves suffering, like it or not, you know, and even if you are one of the scientists I interviewed for this book told me that 90% of the experiments in her bustling lab end in failure, right? And you think, well, okay, they're comfortable with it, and they are, but still each and every one of those failures is a disappointment and there's a little bit of suffering there because if at the very least, because time has just been lost, right? And you're in a hurry to get that publication.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I worked in a venture-backed startup, a high-growth startup in Silicon Valley. And reading your book, you named this very common mantra, fail fast, fail often. And as I was reading through that and thinking about our conversation, I was thinking more about why is it so difficult to fail, which you have an extensive conversation of in the book. And this fail fast, fail often, it's a nice idea. It's a great, it could be a, you know, great kind of mantra. Okay, failure is a good thing and I'll learn and all that type of thing. But in my experience, easier said than done.
Much.
Because of what we're talking about. Because there's, you know, to some degree, and maybe it's very small sometimes and very large other times, suffering or pain or uncomfort or whatever it is. So could you talk a little bit more about what you've learned about the different types of discomfort or suffering or whatever you want to call them that arise that make it hard to fail?
Well, first of all, I'll say it's very, as we've been talking about, spontaneous, right? It's our suffering or our pain or our disappointment. You know, disappointment is the mildest form, our natural and spontaneous reactions to that undesired outcome. That's important. In fact, you could say that a lot of wisdom, maturity, but however you think about it, is a process of learning better how to overcome the natural, spontaneous reaction to life's events, to have a more measured, thoughtful, wise reaction to life's events. And, you know, some people master that reframe more readily than others, or work harder at it and master it. So, you know, we come by our disappointment or our suffering honestly.
Yes.
It makes sense that we would have that feeling. And it makes sense that we need to learn how to rethink it and reframe it as a way of making progress. I mean, again, nobody would ever be able to ride a bicycle if at the you know, the first tipping over, you think, well, this forget it.
That's
right. I'm walking away from this. But I think the other really important thing to dig into around the fail fast, fail often mantra is part of our inability to kind of really embrace it is that intuitively we know that's just not right, right? You can't really be enthusiastically calling for failure. Like, again, that's not what we want. We want success. And so I think part of the problem is it's not adequately contingent. It's not saying fail fast, fail often, so long as you're in new territory in pursuit of a goal with a good hypothesis for what you think might work and why, and it's no bigger than you can afford to bear, you know, if it goes south. You're not using more money, more time, more reputational capital than is strictly speaking necessary for that experiment. And now that was a mouthful, right? But that's, I think the reason that isn't specified is because the people who speak that way understand that.
Yes.
In their minds are those under what conditions factors. They get that, right? Of course, we're entrepreneurs. We're trying something that's never been tried before. We're going to get the funding. We're going, you know, but by not articulating it, it creates almost a bind where people hear the message, they get what it's all about. Oh yeah, innovation, all that good stuff. But they, in their heart of their hearts, they're thinking, no way, not for me. I want success.
And I think you're getting at something really important. You know, I was reading a LinkedIn post from you, I think it was like maybe a week ago or so, and you were just sharing one of your great hopes, and you can correct anything that's wrong here, but I think it was one of your great hopes for 2023 was to really change the conversation and change how people engage with failure so that it's more productive, constructive, this type of thing. And in the book, you talk about one of the first steps to really learning how to fail better is by doing what you just did, which is essentially diagnosing the failure type, right? And there's different types.
Yeah, right.
So that language may be unfamiliar for some. Could you walk us through the failure
Absolutely.
Types?
No, you're right. And I should have gone further in the prior response because the other thing, I mean, implicit in what I said for the fail fast, fail often mantra is, well, I said it should be a new territory with a hypothesis as small as possible. That's my very definition of an intelligent failure. Mm-hmm. And those are truly good, useful, knowledge-bearing failures. They help us get further along towards some goal, whether it's riding a bicycle, you know, finding a life partner or starting a company. And yet there are, of course, other kinds of failures. And these are the kind that, in fact, when we're at our best, we do avoid them. And I call them, the two other archetypes that I identify are, in addition to intelligent failure, are basic failures and complex failures. And basic failures are single cause failures. You know, when I burn the cookies, that's a basic failure. I had a recipe, I had an oven, right? You know, everything was in place for me to get the cookies to turn out right, but I went away and forgot to come back or set a timer or something. So I made that mistake. Boom, basic failure. Nobody should celebrate that. Not that it was terribly consequential, but fair, some fair basic point. Failures are terribly consequential. And then the other kind are complex failures, which are unfortunately on the rise in our complex world. But these are the multi-causal failures that are, like basic failures, in relatively familiar territory where we have pretty good knowledge about how to get the result we want. But because of a handful of factors that come together in just the wrong way, we get the undesired result instead. And the main distinction there is that any one of the factors on its own wouldn't have caused the failure, right? There's a small deviation here, a slight problem over there. None of them all would have led to a really bad outcome, but the unfortunate way they came together led to the bad outcome. And best practice in organizations and in our lives are to try to avoid, prevent the complex failures, to be alert to the small deviations and take them seriously and speak up about them and catch and correct things before worse things happen.
Absolutely. I want to come back to complex failures in just a little bit, but I'd love to switch gears for just a moment and share with you a question that I've been exploring on the show with many, many guests for years now. It's really been a central question of the show, and it came from a poet and a spiritual teacher, bestselling author named Mark Nepo. You might be familiar with that name. I don't know. He, during our time together, said that from his perspective, he felt that this was one of the most important questions that we might ask ourselves in our life. And it's not really a question that has a simple answer or a static answer. In his view, it's more a question that we carry with us kind of as a companion throughout our lives, right? Huh. And we come back to, and the answers may evolve and change. And the question is, when my heart begins to close, how do I open it again? And this has really evolved on the show to be more than about the physical heart, to how do I stay, or how do I remain more open to learning, to growth, more responsive, as you were describing in your early story, versus reactive, that knee-jerk reaction that comes
right.
out, right? Ooh, coming from a place of choice. So very simply put, coming more often from a place of love versus fear. Big question. And there's two angles that I would really love to explore with you related to your work in the book. So the first is, because failure can bring with it, as we talked about, this whole host of unpleasant feelings. There might be shame, there might be embarrassment, there might be the pain of feeling rejected, or I don't fit in right anymore, or I let the group down. The list goes on. It seems like staying open to learning from failure can be difficult, or could be difficult, right? So when we begin to close down, when we fail, okay, I did this thing I care about, I tried out a new experiment, I tested a new product, I whatever, tried dating again for the first time after a divorce, whatever it is. When we start to close down, what have you learned about how we can stay open and truly learn from our failures? Is there maybe one or two highlights that come to mind for you from your work?
Two possible helpers come to mind, right? One is the good friends, or the good friend, or the sibling, or the partner, some way, who is willing to, really honestly willing to hold up the mirror, right? Honestly willing to sort of help you, walk down back to ground, back to concrete, reality versus the naturally exaggerated reaction we have to disappointments. You know, we talked about the suffering before. So, I think a good friend, a good colleague, partner, isn't just going to indulge you in the ain't it awful, but is going to help you see things a new way. And then I think the other helper is what you're talking about, which is, there's so many beautiful books and teachings out there that can truly help us learn and grow and put things in perspective and develop some of the mental and emotional habits that we need to rethink and reconnect with perspective, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. If I was to take this question even a step further and bring it directly into your wheelhouse, because you're working with some of the top organizations in the world and the top leaders. So if we were to pose this question within the organizational context or the leadership context, and there's a failure and start to close down to learning, move on, brush it under the rug, whatever, I just kind of close off to it. Is there anything that you are talking about with these leaders or teams about how do we open back up again to really learn from it?
I'm often talking about the simple act of choosing learning over knowing. And that is to say, that is to recognize that our spontaneous, again, our spontaneous reaction is of knowing. We think we're right. Like we've sized up the situation, we've got the causal map, and we're right. We rarely spontaneously, although I think we can get better at it, think, I wonder what I'm missing. Like, I wonder where I'm not right here. Where is my first glance assessment of what's going on wrong? To me, that is an act of choosing learning, right? And learning's uncomfortable, even though it's fun. It's uncomfortable because it's sort of saying, I have to deliberately, explicitly let go of what I believe to be true and instead say, what am I missing?
I love that. There's a curiosity there. There's like
there's curiosity and humility, both.
And humility, both. Yeah. An assumption that something is probably missing or that I'm wrong in some way.
And it's almost certainly true, right? It's an assumption,
exactly.
But like how on earth could I have omniscience? I can't. So therefore, I'm definitely missing something. It's just that I'm I have to remind myself that is a fact and then get curious about what it might be.
Well, and particularly in the, like you were describing earlier, you know, the complexity that we find ourselves in this changing world of work. I mean, it's just so that you might be missing something. Yeah.
Yeah. And other people's experience is going to be different. Like we're at risk of thinking that others are seeing the situation the same way we are. And then we are often surprised when we discover that they see it very differently. Sometimes the valence is different. They're positive, I'm negative, or vice versa. Sometimes just the details are different, or they see things I miss in the details and vice versa.
I love that. And the second way I want to explore this question with you is less on the individual and more about kind of outward, like helping others to open back up again. So I'm going to come back to your LinkedIn post for just a moment that I read, and you wrote a hope for 2024 in there. And I remember one of them was talking about moving from anger or blame or shaming to more kindness. Like, how do we make some of that shift? And there were a bunch of other things that you named for your hopes for 2024, ways in which you might be able to help and what you're interested in. And this kind of fits in there. I was really struck that when it comes to failure, sometimes that knee-jerk response is blame another person. Who's to blame for this?
Absolutely.
Right? Point the finger.
Yeah. I need to be off the hook.
Right. And talk about a natural kind of human response. This is so frequent. And it's a closing down.
Exactly right. So blame is natural, and blame or any simple and quick causal analysis is a closing down. Because now, okay, I got it. It's figured out and I'm done.
Right. And what I loved in your book, one of the many things was that you talked about blame and you really kind of got into the nuances of it. When are failures sort of blame worthy, and what situations or contexts or what are the details there? And I think one of the takeaways for me was blame is warranted maybe a lot less than it's actually done or experienced. So
well put. Yes, exactly. So I think sometimes we're at risk of, I mean, in practice, in organizations, I think there's often a lot of blame going around. Something goes wrong. Okay, who's the culprit? Who did it? We need someone to blame or something to blame. And then I think the counterpart to that is, we have to not blame. Well, there are blameworthy acts, and they are few and far between. Mm-hmm. So what's a blameworthy act, right? If you are a physician in a hospital and you come to work drunk, right, and you do something wrong, even coming to work drunk is a but that's a blameworthy act, right? And you should be blamed. We'll figure out how to help you, but there is no question that's a behavior that we must never see again. But here's the strange phenomenon is that we have this human tendency and organizational tendency to respond to many, if not most, failures as if they were caused by blameworthy acts, and then we're instinctively looking for the culprit, the person to blame. Whereas I would argue the actual prevalence of blameworthy acts is very small in most organizations.
And I think one of the downsides of blame, and you are an expert on this, I mean, I know very little, just kind of have my experience. But I think one of the downsides from my experience of blame when we do point a finger is oftentimes it really closes the door to a lot of learning that can happen.
It shuts down learning, first and foremost. And it's very likely to be incomplete, inadequate. So that first, it may have, whatever it is you're blaming, very well may have played a causal role in the failure, but it's almost certainly not a complete causal role. And now, once we've blamed, we don't have to think anymore. So it shuts down learning, as you said, indeed. And it reinforces this kind of simplistic causal thinking, as opposed to the more complex causal thinking that actually explains things in our complex world.
So if I have a team where I'm in an experience where there's been a failure and my knee-jerk reaction is blame, okay, notice that comes up, those thoughts right. come up in my mind. And then what's the next step to get to a constructive response for you? Like, what would you say I should do after those knee-jerk thoughts come
up? Yes, because that's going to happen, right? So then breathe, just
take a breath,
pause, breathe, and force yourself to ask the following question. What happened, right? Because I think it's hard to go from, okay, I blame that, to, well, maybe I shouldn't blame that. It's like, we'll just leave that aside for now. And instead of trying to figure out, is that right, wrong? We're just going to ask the simple question, what happened? And we're going to try to tell the story of what happened as fully and concretely as we can. And in the answer to what happened, we'll almost always see multiple factors that ultimately contributed to the outcome, things that happened, and omission, things that didn't happen that maybe should have happened, that check that we didn't make, that call that didn't happen. And so it's the shift from almost scientific, this is odd, but from that scientific instinct of like, okay, I get it, I know what happened, I blame, to the storyteller perspective, which is, well, let's just slow down here. Let's take a look what happened.
And I think one thing, I don't know about your experience, but one thing I'm thinking about as we're going through that conversation, knee-jerk thought, who's to blame? Move past that, take a breath. What happened? Someone shares, this thing happened. Then that knee-jerk reaction could come up again and again and again.
Yeah, it could, yeah.
Throughout, but you know.
And you keep saying to it, okay, thanks for sharing, you know, inside your head. It's like, well, right. Thanks for sharing, well, you know. We'll put that in the mix. We'll keep that here in the mix, but we're not going to put it in charge yet.
Yeah. And it takes a real culture. I mean, this just brings up, obviously, your other work that you've spent so much time and energy in around psychological safety, around creating these conditions where people, when you ask the question, what happened here in response to failure, people actually feel they can honestly, openly share.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's who is the best? I'm just so curious about this. Who is a leader for you that is like an exemplar in creating the conditions where people feel like they can share honestly, openly to that question? What happened here? Why did this fail?
I'm going to answer that with a person and a story that's pretty, a business story that's pretty well known.
Please.
So that it isn't just someone I know that nobody else
sure.
would know.
Please.
Which is Alan Mulally. And Alan Mulally, a decade or more ago, actually more than a decade ago, came into Ford from the outside at the time when they were in serious, you know, company-threatening trouble, financial trouble. And why I love this particular example is this isn't about just being, you know, this isn't about being nice or warm or soft, but about being direct and conveying expectations that's what we do around here. We'll be direct. We'll tell the truth and we will tell it in a timely way. So this is the aspiration that he gives his top team. That is not how they're behaving, and that is certainly not how they start behaving on day one of his arrival. I mean, it takes actually quite a few weeks of not telling the truth, not speaking up about the many challenges, problems, issues that they are aware of in their different roles, until finally Mullally says, you know, listen, it's like several weeks into it. You know, we are on track here to lose $17 billion, that's a B, dollars this year, right? So what isn't going well? And as the story goes, Mark Fields, head of all the North, you know, all of the Americas, North, South, this, you know, at that point, he's almost giving up anyway. So it's like, what the heck, right? And he does proceed to describe a very serious problem with a new vehicle launch, you know, big problem. And, you know, everyone in the room apparently is thinking this is his last day at Ford, right? Their experience had taught them that if you speak truth to power, you're out. It's obviously not what happened. That really was sort of the day that people began to think maybe this guy's for real. And how Mullally actually reacted was, Mark, thanks for that clear line of sight. How can we help? Right. So it's not warm and fuzzy. It's just appreciative and forward looking. And that to me is the essence of psychological safety. It's when you speak honestly, you don't get fired. You don't get belittled. You don't get shamed. In a sense, you get offered help because that's what we need. Because it's not about you. It's about us and our aspiration to do something really great together, which is not easy to do.
And these two things, learning and getting better at failing and psychological safety, they just go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Like. Yeah. I mean, so I think you will see, readers will see that the psychological safety work, it's not what the book's about, but it runs through. It's mentioned several places, and it's very hard to fail well if you don't have psychological safety, you know, in your family or in your team at work. I mean, you've got to have that belief that we can tell the truth. We can report what's really going on. We can neither do good innovation, nor can we do good failure prevention in known territory.
Right. I wanted to explore something with you, and this came up at sort of toward the end of your book, and I'd love to just share a passage just to honor your work and then maybe see what you think about it now after the book's been published. So I think the essence here, the idea, is that failure as it stands in our society, particularly I'll just speak to the U.S., is not an equal opportunity proposition. Right. It's just not based upon the way that we identify. I mean, identify as white, male, heterosexual. There's a lot of power, status, privilege that comes with that, et cetera, in our society. So if we're in the dominant class, if we have power within an organization due to our title, et cetera, like failure is just not equal opportunity right now. And you address this in your book. You say, the more I study the research on the psychology, sociology, and economics of inequality, the more massive the undertaking of correcting these societal failures feels. And then you write, and I love this, at the very least, I argue that as a society, we should aspire to creating a world where everyone has an equal license to fail intelligently. And then you state right after that, that's not the case today. Then you go on to say that you have some hope, though, that maybe we're moving the needle a little bit, right? A little bit here and there. I'm curious about what you've seen that's giving you some of that hope, or what are some of the things that we may need to do or continue to practice that may help move the needle a little bit? I recognize huge question, but maybe there's one or two things that you've learned.
With that, steps forward often come, you know, two steps forward, one back. But I would say the primary rationale for hope is greater awareness. So the reason why, I mean, one of the reasons why there's unequal license to fail is that if you are in a role, you know, whether it's entrepreneur or senior executive, that people in your identity group are underrepresented in, then you are just psychologically, not yourself, but other people's perception of you, they are more likely, it's a natural process of stereotyping, to see you. You know, it's like, if someone older in your life might say, a lady doctor, right? Whereas physician just says, I'm a doctor, right? I'm not a lady doctor, I'm a doctor. But the process of, seeing someone as kind of unusual in that role, you're naturally stereotyping, you're naturally associating that identity to them in that role. Now, if that person, that underrepresented person in such a role has a failure, observers will naturally not just, that's just, an individual who had a failure, they'll attribute it to the group, right? That's sort of what happens when you put people in, in that role in some sense. That's either conscious or subconscious. So, I think two good things have happened. One is there's just more societal awareness of inequality and unequal access to those desired roles. And the other is we're more aware that we're likely to make those inferences erroneously. And so we can then, or at least more and more people are in a position to catch and correct themselves while they're making it. And the work on implicit bias, beautiful work of Mazarin Banaji and others, shows that, no matter how much you, as I do, you care about these things, you're still at risk of the implicit bias. I mean, you will still, she'll do those tests and you will still, or at least I, Amy Edmondson, will more quickly, nanoseconds, associate the sort of terminology of work with men than with women, and the kitchen and so forth more quickly with women. Fortunately, my kids don't have that problem because their dad did all the cooking, but these kind of just very deep grained stereotypes that we have are with us even when we've worked hard at it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts on that. It was very striking, and your hope and kind of vision for that just being added to the book. I love, so I wanted to underscore that. As we move toward a close, there's like maybe 10 minutes or so left here. I wanted to talk to you about, something that I loved in the book, which is just your kind of giving people permission to be human. I look at this, kind of superpower in our constantly changing world. I'm just going to call it that, of being able to relax into uncertainty.
Right.
Just being able to be
with
it.
It is what it is.
And I love that, that you say that. You frequently underscore that. And you just say, as human beings, we are fallible. Vulnerability is a fact.
Yeah. Right.
I know. I love that.
So much of the work on vulnerability is like, oh, should I be vulnerable? Not like it or not, you're vulnerable. The question is, are you willing to show it, or be honest about it?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful reminder. And I think there's even a chapter in the book that says, to err is human. How human of us.
Yeah, chapter 3, to err is human. And that's the chapter on basic failures. So it's really trying to say, we know we'll make mistakes. The question is, can we catch them and correct them? Can our colleagues catch them and correct them and speak up about them quickly enough to prevent the preventable failures in our lives and work?
And this type of acceptance feels like a strategy for remaining open to learning from failure.
And I got all, of course, I got all of this from the great people I've learned from. But one of them was an African-American psychiatrist named Maxie Maltsby, who I talk about in chapter 5, from whom I learned the phrase fallible human being, or FHB for short. and Maxie used to say, we're all FHBs, right? That's who we are.
Human.
So get over it. And and then if you can really, and I'm not good at this, but if you can really accept that as a given and then say, now, what do I do with it? I'm going to need help from others and I'm going to need to be honest. And I suppose that's just a countervailing force to perfectionism, which is such an unhealthy tendency.
One of the things I love too, just to get really practical here for a moment, as we continue to talk about getting better at failing, learning from failure, was your focus on practicing, experimenting, in small, low stakes environments. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I have, I almost playfully say, you should decide to fail more often. But I mean it seriously. But what does that really mean? That means take more risks, do more new things. Don't just stick with what you're already good at. Don't just take the safe bets. You know, don't set your targets at the level where you know for sure you can achieve them, but rather be willing to, you know, to stretch and grow. And I give the story of a childhood in high school, very dear friend of mine, who in her 40s picked up ice hockey, which, God, I still can't quite imagine doing that. But I remember at the time thinking, like, why on earth would she want to do that? Like, she's going to be really bad at it. And yet she picked it up. She loved it. She persevered. You know, she got less bad at it as time went on. And today she says that ice hockey is her passion.
I just love how now I think you're smiling more. The energy's changed. It's kind of like there's this playfulness, this humanness, this experimentation, like have a bit of fun with this too. And I love that focus too on the small stakes environments as well. But just share briefly with you, I've been a coach for quite a while now. And one of the areas I used to focus on a lot was stress management. And I used to give this example because I think about this quite often. In college, I worked at our recreation center, University Recreation Center at Davis. And I was the person that if somebody had a student had an accident or they were having an allergic reaction or something happened, I'd call the EMTs to come. And I was always struck when the EMTs would show up, open the door, and I'd walk them, you know, over to the scene where the student's in need of help. And people could be freaking out, right? Like crying or whatever it is.
Yeah, scared.
It could be a life or death situation. It really could at sometimes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And the EMTs were so calm.
Yeah.
And they were so focused and they were so responsive. It's just like, this is what we're doing. And they were communicating clearly. And it was just really high functioning team. And part of the reason for that, I believe, is they're practicing in low stakes moments when it doesn't matter as much, when it's their off time, right?
They were not born that way. Let's put it that way, right? That is not a special personality. That is a learned skill. And that's why I talk a little bit about what do you do, you know, with the false alarm? Like someone says, oh, we got a big problem here. And then it turns out it isn't. You treat that as the practice drill that it is. And you keep honoring it. Like, thank you so much for bringing that to my attention, right? And it's just, it's that opportunity to practice and practice.
Beautiful. I love that. Amy, you've shared so much today. Thank you so much for coming back on and sharing your wisdom and your expertise on the show. It's always a joy to be with you. As we close, I'm curious if there's maybe a closing thought, something that either is new that's emerging for you that you haven't shared, or something you'd like to underscore again. And maybe framing it in this way, when, you know, folks are out there listening and they want to learn or get better at failing. Learning to do that. Is there something you'd like to share?
What came to mind was the opening quote, the epigraph for the book, which is from a novelist of 150 years ago, Louisa May Alcott, who says, "I am not afraid of storms, for I'm learning how to sail my ship." And that really speaks to me because the storms are there. The storms are going to intensify. Like, we can't wish them away. So we have no choice but to learn how to sail our ships. But I think, unlike Alcott's quote, this is a team sport. The way that we are going to sail together through the coming storms is going to have to be collaborative, with a lot of communication, a lot of creativity and ingenuity and compassion, to use your important word.
Wonderful. If people want to find out more about you, where are the best places for them to do that?
LinkedIn. Or amycedmondson.com, I suppose.
Thank you so much again, Amy, for being here.
Such a pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Courageous Life. I'd like to extend special thanks, as always, to my executive producer, Matt Donner, for all of the incredible behind-the-scenes work he does to make this show sound great. He's also responsible for composing the original music that you hear at the beginning and the end of every episode. Also, if you're enjoying the show and the conversation, please do share with friends, because I believe that courage is contagious. And while you're at it, if you happen to be on iTunes, make sure you click the subscribe button, or if you feel so compelled, leave a positive review. It encourages me to keep going and also helps others to find a valuable show amidst the many podcasts that are out there. Until next time, this is Joshua Steinfeld with The Courageous Life.